The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.
From St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking. 12 years ago, Shane Scholer was the Republican standard bearer for Secretary of State. And after narrowly losing to Democrat Jason Kander, Scholer was able to rebound by becoming Greene County's clerk. On the latest episode of Politically Speaking, the Republican countywide official explains why he's the most experienced person for the job out of the 8 Republicans seeking to succeed Secretary of State Jay Ashcroft. He also talked about the uncertain future of efforts to make the Missouri Constitution harder to amend. Let's hit the music.
This is the Politically Speaking podcast, the definitive show about Missouri politics.
My promise to St. Louis was that I would do the absolute most for each and every person, starting with those who have the very least.
What I wanted to do was look and see what other states are doing.
We have to be willing to change those laws, that they are balanced and they affect everybody equally.
As somebody that grew up in the St. Louis area, in North St. Louis County, I didn't know any lawyers growing up.
We got to find long-term solutions to make government better, but also to be able to provide services to people.
I don't want to leave that federal money that we've been leaving all these years on the table.
We need to be spending this money to take care of Missourians.
I thought we accomplished a lot this year, but a lot more needs to be done.
And welcome to Politically Speaking. I'm your host, St. Louis Public Radio political correspondent Jason Rosenbaum. And in studio today, we have a veteran of the 2000s era Missouri General Assembly, my favorite era of the General Assembly, by the way. And he is one of 8 Republicans seeking to become the next Secretary of State.
Shane Scholer.
Welcome to Politically Speaking in person. The last time you were on the show was when the pandemic happened. You did a fabulous podcast about early absentee mail-in voting with Boone County Clerk Brianna Lennon. But now you're back in the statewide electoral arena. For our listeners who may not have been paying attention to Missouri politics in 2012 or may have not been born yet, I'm sure there are some 12-year-olds to listen to this show.
There you go.
Tell us a little bit about yourself and why you decided to get into this race.
Well, for the better part, I grew up in the Ozarks after we moved from Kansas. Grew up there in Branson. Went to college at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar. And my wife and I, we got married in 2001 and lived for a few years in Columbia while she was in law school. And during that period of time, I worked for then Secretary of State Matt Blunt, which is really the year before that, 2000, and during that period of time I worked for him is where my passion for elections really began to grow because of some of the challenges we saw in the city of St. Louis on election night 2000 during that November general election. And then after we went back to the Ozarks, we settled there in Greene County. We now live in Willard. And in 2005, I guess it was actually 2006, I decided to run for the Missouri General Assembly for North Greene County, North Springfield, and was there for 3 terms and really enjoyed that period of time I was in legislature. And I would agree, it was a great time to be in the Missouri General Assembly.
I will just add, though, there are some people that say that the 2000s era legislature was this place of infinite harmony and no conflict and that everybody were statesmen. I would strongly disagree with that. There were some pretty ugly moments in both chambers. Like, I do remember that Trent Skaggs and Brian Nieves almost got into a fist fight. I'm sure that was a great moment for everybody. But I don't know. That's just my random Jason Rosenbaum has been a reporter since 2006 interjection, but continue.
Yeah, well, we had the village law. That was my first session, I believe, or second session for sure. And so that was a very interesting period of time to be in the legislature, if you recall that.
Yes,
particular,
just Google village law. I'm not going to explain
no,
it on
we
the
don't,
show.
No, we don't want to go into it. But there were challenges during that period of time. And then at the end of my term there in 2012, I was the nominee for Secretary of State, narrowly lost to Jason Kander in that election. And then a couple years later, my predecessor, who was county clerk in Greene County for 27 years, Richard Struckoff, he decided not to run again. And that's when I ran for Greene County clerk, and that's where I'm at today.
So I would say that because you have run statewide before and you won a contested primary before, on paper you would be seen as like a prime candidate to win this eight-person primary. But I could also be in the shoes of a Republican voter that wasn't paying attention to politics in 2012, may not know who you are, may not be from Greene County, and you may just get lost in the shuffle of not only all the other candidates that are running for Secretary of State, but like every other office. How are you going to be able to stand out when this is such a crazy primary season?
Well, what I like to tell folks is there are a lot of good folks running for Secretary of State. I do joke eight is enough in terms of the people that are running, in terms of all eight of us. But at the end of the day, I think what distinguishes me from everyone else is I've actually been administering elections for the past 10 years. And no different than when you think about voting for sheriff, you want someone who has law enforcement experience before they become the sheriff of your county. I strongly believe we need someone who has election experience to become the next Secretary of State.
So let's talk about the office.
Yes.
And we can talk about the dynamics of this race all day long, but frankly, in a race with eight candidates who have different degrees of viability, I feel like that's kind of a pointless exercise. I think it's more important to know what you would actually do. So what would you do differently from Secretary Ashcroft? Like, what are some changes that you would want to make to the office if you're elected?
Well, one of the things when you think about business services, critical component to Secretary of State's office, anytime you go to start a business, you're going to go to the Secretary of State's office to get that business license. One of the things that if you begin to do some research into new businesses, one of the things that's really challenging for new business owners is financial literacy. Why don't we put some tools there as they're getting their business registered that actually empower them with financial literacy information? No mandates. I don't want the legislature anyway mandate this, but say, here are some really good tools that you can use, some good information that will help you be able to not only have the passion for your business, but the knowledge to know how to run the business. And I think that's just an easy thing that we can do through the Secretary of State's office that I think makes a lot of common sense for folks that are in business here in the state of Missouri. And so I want to be able to do that through the Business Service Division. And I think also when you think about, what happens in investment protection, of course, go ahead.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question about securities. I'm asking all the candidates, like, what would you do about securities regulation? But frankly, number one, I don't know enough about securities to really know what is considered good or bad management of it. And number two, is any candidate that comes and speaks with us really going to say anything different from, I'm going to just protect your securities to the best of my ability? Like, is there any way to, like, innovate that part of the office? Or is everybody just going to say, we're going to do the best we can, and that's good enough?
I think that's one of the areas you partner with your local libraries, and you say, how can we help educate anyone who's investing in the hard-earned dollars to make sure that they know what to look out for when it comes to potential scams? And especially when you're in difficult economic times like we are right now, people's budgets are being stretched thin. A lot of times that's when someone who has a scam is going to come up to them and it's almost too good to be true. Let's empower those investors with information. And of course, the Secretary of State, you know, we have the state library. We work with the local libraries. We don't run them. We work with them. Why not have a partnership there where you're working with them to be able to go across the state and be able to educate investors?
Well, you're a good segue here because my next questions were about libraries. And
You gave me no notes beforehand. So.
No notes beforehand. And again, I have to make this disclaimer before I talk about this. My wife is a librarian at Washington University, but she does not like work for a library that likely gets Secretary of State money. Mm-hmm. But obviously she has a lot of opinions about, you know, Secretary of State library interactions. And because the reason it's gotten so much attention in the last couple of years is Secretary Ashcroft created a series of rules about funding for libraries. As you said, like, we need to dispel this misconception. Like, the Secretary of State's office does not run local libraries.
Correct.
They just provide money for them. Mm-hmm. And I think, and I'm trying to paraphrase the best way I can, he basically is like, we won't give you money if you don't have a policy about how you're going to handle inappropriate books and make sure they're not put in like the children's section, which I think is different from people who, you know, want to like ban books or remove books. But I do think it brings up some noteworthy questions about like how much should a governmental entity be telling like a local library how to manage its content, so to speak. So what would you kind of do in that space that may be the same as Secretary Ashcroft or maybe a little bit different?
Well, I think first of all, local libraries are most commonly supported by your property tax dollars. There are some private libraries, as we well know, but the ones that are supported by your local property tax dollars, they have library boards that are usually appointed by either county commissions and or city officials, mayors, and the councils, for example. They have a role in appointing them. That's where, in my opinion, the management of your libraries begins first and foremost, is who's on that library board there locally working with their library to be able to communicate with them. And so I've talked with people about that. I'm like, you need to talk with your commissioners. You need to talk with your city councils. You need to let them know that you have an interest in them in terms of what's happening at your local library and get on that board so you can have a say in what's happening in terms of the direction of your local library. And that's what I think is first and most important, that you know, the answers rarely come from Washington, D.C. or Jefferson City. They're going to come from right there in your community. So that's important.
We had Senator Mary Elizabeth Coleman on, and she was talking about like pushing for more library boards to be elected, because I think most of them are probably appointed, I would assume. There's probably some that are elected.
I'm not aware of any.
Yeah. What do you think about that idea? Because on the one hand, like, it could provide a level of public accountability, but on the other hand, like, I could see some people getting on those boards who may be very itchy to just start removing books that they don't like, and it gets into like a lot of subjective questions about what is appropriate and inappropriate, but they're going to just be making the decisions that way.
Yeah. Well, as county clerk, I always liked the idea of elections, as you can imagine. I do think, though, that one of the things we see, especially with some of our smaller fire protection districts, some of our smaller schools, funding an election is not insignificant for any political subdivision. And so I think we've got to ensure that they do have the funding to be able to fund elections before we even have that conversation. And I don't know if she's done that research or not, but that's the first question we've got to really examine and take a look at that. And look at where our library board's at in terms of the appointment process, because whether you're appointed or whether you're elected, you still have the people who are elected to those offices make those appointments, and there's accountability in that as well. So I'm certainly willing to have that discussion, but I have not made a decision in terms of if that's the best solution to the challenges we have in terms of some of the issues that have been brought to the forefront that Secretary Ashcroft tried to address.
So let's talk about elections, which is often the most high-profile topic area with Secretary of State. I would say that one of the prime responsibilities of the Secretary of State's office is to coordinate with the county's local election officials.
Mm-hmm.
Before I ask the next question, how do you think Secretary Ashcroft has done in that capacity compared to, like, Secretary Kander, who you ran against and probably had some disagreements with? But I've kind of noticed that, like, some of the county clerks, even on the Republican or Democratic level, had ideas about election administration that weren't like radically different from Secretary Ashcroft, but I think there were a number of differences of opinion over like the 8-year span. So like, mm-hmm. how would you rate his, in a post-mortem way, his relationship with the county clerks?
I think that, you know, there have been periods of time where there were some challenges, especially during COVID, as you could imagine. There's some difference in thoughts in terms of how we should proceed forward. But to Secretary Ashcroft's credit, he did work with us once we made a decision, for example, to postpone the election in June, and came along to help us with that. We did have some pretty tense discussions, you know, in terms of what the best way was to proceed. But I think there were a lot of different entities having discussions, not just about elections, about a lot of things, about how do you proceed forward in a period there was a lot of uncertainty. So, you know, I appreciate that he has worked with us. He's, you know, tried to put the right people that I think he feels can help us. But I do think that as a county clerk, I come with advantage. I already know how to have those discussions from day one. And that's the difference that I think really is critical, because I see the challenges and I also look at solutions that we can implement, especially when it comes to elections, to make a difference.
So let's talk about one of the election administration issues that's been brought up by a couple of your opponents, and that's hand counting ballots instead of running them through election machines. What's kind of your general thoughts on that idea?
Well, what I try to remind people is we need to understand the history of hand counting. And one of the reasons we went to machines years ago was because hand counting was fraudulent. It had errors during that period of time. Matter of fact, I've got an article that I like to mention to folks from the St. Louis Globe Democrat back in 1955. And in it, it says, in a special report on voting machines, the Board of Election Commissioners said flagrant fraud such as stuffing ballot boxes, changing vote ballots as they are tabulated, marking tally sheets for the wrong candidate, and deliberately calling voted ballots incorrectly are stopped by the use of voting machines. So I try to encourage people, let's remember our history before we go back and repeat it.
Yeah, and I'm going to be very candid here. I think that the whole hand counting ballot thing emanates from people like Mike Lindell, who have basically put forth some crazy theories about, like, election machines being tampered with or hacked or whatever. I've always thought, though, that, like, vote counting machines aren't connected to the internet usually. So I'm having a hard time figuring out, like, how something like that could actually occur if unless, like, there's an unscrupulous county clerk that has decided to plug a modem into a machine. So can you address that? Do you think that's where this hand counting thing is coming from?
Well, certainly. There's concerns that the machine's being compromised, being hacked. But what I try to tell people is no election authority puts blind faith in the machine itself. That's why we do the pre-testing. We want to make sure the coding on the ballot is correct. We do the post-testing. And then we do no less than 5% of the precincts that were voted on that day. We randomly draw those. And then we have, for example, in a federal election, we'll count a statewide candidate, either for president or any of the statewide candidates for governor on down the ticket. And then those are randomly drawn. And then we do one for the legislative, either Missouri General Assembly or congressional. We also do one for the county. We do one for the judiciary. So anything from the local circuit to the appellate to the Supreme Court. And then finally, we do an issue. So all of those are hand counted and they're compared to the machine and the tabulation of that day. And I tell people, I'm in my 10th year as county clerk and done multiple hand counts to verify the machine count. We've had ties, we've had one vote outcomes, and I've yet to have a hand count overturned to machine count. If that's going to happen, Jason, normally it's going to be because the voter, for example, filled in both ovals, but then pointed an arrow and said that they wanted to vote for this particular individual, or they circled the names versus filling in the oval. The machine's not programmed to be able to read that. That's where in a very close election you might have a change, assuming the program is correct. But occasionally you do have incorrect program. It happened over in Kansas a couple of years ago, but they caught it in the post-testing audit. And that's what's critical, is you don't put blind faith in them. You always have to do the testing afterward and the auditing.
So just to make sure I understand you, you would not say that all election authorities in the state would have to hand count all their ballots, but you would maybe want it as an option in an extremely close election that's maybe like one or two votes, and then you could like look for those types of, I don't want to say oddities because I feel like that happens all the time, but like circling somebody Amen. Instead of filling in the oval,
well,
stuff like that.
After every election, the Dakota state regulations require you to do a hand count of no less than 5% of the voting precincts
yeah.
that day. So that always happens. Now, for example, in 2020, to your point, we had a very close election for state legislative seat, the 135th. Out of almost 18,000 ballots cast, 76 votes separated the top two candidates. What I did is I called the candidates, I called the party chairs, I invited them to be there part of the process until we confirmed that we knew we had to do a recount before we certified. And then we invited the media, we did an open public space, we had Republicans and Democrats sitting together, and every ballot that was cast in the machines was hand counted, and everyone got to see that. It was open and transparent. And that way, when we certified the outcome, no one had any questions. And so certainly in close elections, it makes sense to go back through and do something where the eye can see the ballot visibly. So when you certify it, people don't have questions.
We'll be right back after this quick break with Secretary of State hopeful Shane Scholler. And we're back on Politically Speaking with Greene County Clerk Shane Scholler. He's one of eight Republicans seeking to succeed Secretary of State Jay Ashcroft, who is running for governor. So let's talk about absentee ballots. So one of the biggest permanent changes that I would argue happened under Ashcroft's Secretary of State tenure was the implementation of an early voting period where you can go in person to a designated place and cast your ballot for any reason. What do you think of this system, and would you have it changed at all?
No. Something I've always supported is that people have the opportunity to be able to come in and vote prior to the election, show their photo ID, and be able to cast that ballot without having to give a reason. I think that two-week period is very helpful when you're a local election authority. I'm going to give you an example, Jason. For example, my first election in 2016, we had on that day almost 8,000 address changes in 80 polling locations. Well, one of the things that's helpful when you are able to vote prior to the election is we know those people that come in are likely going to be part of those people that have address changes that need to take place. The more of those things we can filter out from the day of the election, likely we have less longer lines that discourage people from voting. And if there is a challenge that needs to be addressed, we've got more time to address that challenge versus trying to keep up with every polling location and all the issues they're calling in about as the address changes occur. Those are administrative things that help us run better elections. And so I'm certainly supportive of that two-week period of not having to give a reason.
So the last time I talked with you, we in Clerk Lennon in Boone County, it was talking about a temporary change to the mail-in process where they basically had, I guess, another checkbox that you could just check for any reason. I think it was like you may be susceptible to COVID.
High risk or something.
And it's interesting that, like, Missouri made those changes. And I think they also had, I guess, more robust early voting options, if I recall correctly. And it was amidst all this, like, national Republican outcry over, like, which I'm just going to call early voting. I don't like the term mail-in voting because I think it gives the connotation that ballots are being proactively mailed to people, which happens, I think, in like Oregon and Washington. And that's not what was happening here.
Correct.
You still needed to get it. But I just kind of found that, like, Missouri's example, where the early voting options were used quite a bit and the Republicans still won all their elections by a lot, really poked a pretty big hole in this idea that, like, absentee or early voting was somehow unfair to Republicans or was rife with fraud. And I think that, like, Donald Trump himself has maybe come to that realization because his campaign is now, like, actively telling people to vote early. But, like, I still think that there's part of the Republican base that just doesn't like early or mail-in voting because Trump has spent a lot of time demonizing it. So that's more of an observation than a question, but I'd like you to kind of respond to that.
Well, I always like to say I like the VIP model, vote in person. I do think that's always best because you're able to see that ballot cast. Anytime we send out a ballot and the U.S. Postal Service takes it, at that point it has to get to the voter and then it has to be returned in mail most of the times back to the office. There are opportunities for that ballot not to be returned to our office, and we get voters very frustrated at us after that fact, and they yell at us, well, there's nothing we can do, and we mailed it, especially when we mailed it properly and on time and everything, to that voter. And so I definitely think that you always need to have an option for those who cannot make it to the polling location because they have something physically that prevents them. Those that are military and overseas, those that are going to be traveling the day of the election away from the county, all of that makes sense because we want to make sure their voice is heard. And certainly when the legislature passed that provision, they sunset it. I think that made sense. Number two, it was not arbitrarily done by an executive order like we saw in other states. And And it was, you know, again, you had to be at high risk for COVID in terms of you were exposed to it. It would be particularly harmful to your health. And then it also, the mail-in ballot provision required that ballot to be notarized. So there were a lot of checks and balances in that. And I'll tell you, my first election, we had about 10,000 people vote before the day of the election for November 2016. 3,000 voted by mail. In 2020, we had approximately 30,000, give or take, that voted for the election. Almost half voted by mail, and a little over half voted in person for that particular election. And what that really helped me be able to do, Jason, was look at our chain of custody procedures, and it really helped us improve them as we went through that election, and we're much better for it now.
So let's talk about the bane of my existence, which is the excuse-based absentee system that you just alluded to.
Yes.
I don't usually get all ragey and opinion-y on this show, but after talking with a lot of county clerks and election officials over especially the COVID and post-COVID era, I've really come to the conclusion that the excuse-based system, which, as you mentioned, you have to check off a box that you won't be in town that day, mm-hmm. you're ill, you know, you're going to be working the election that day. That is one of the areas where I think people can find out if you're lying or not. But that's probably the only one. The other ones, though, everybody has told me there's no way to actually enforce that people are actually telling the truth. Like, there's no investigators that county clerks have.
And there shouldn't be.
Is it time to just get rid of that system? Because it seems like a joke.
Well,
I know I'm coming on strong here, but it kind of does come off as a joke to me.
And this is one area where I think, you know, I'm a conservative Republican. I don't particularly like the government knowing what I'm doing. And so I've never been in favor of the excuse-based system because, frankly, if we're going to allow people to vote prior to the election, one, we may want to make sure if they're doing a person to do with photo ID, if they're away, that they go ahead and get that ballot notarized so we confirm who they are. But at the end of the day, if we're going to allow it, we should not be prying into people's lives as to the why. And I think that's critically important. Now, certainly, you know, you don't have to get a notary if you're sick or affirmed. And so I think you have to have that provision for people that are voting to make sure that they can at least check that box. That's why they were not able to be able to have it notarized. That's what we have in law now. I think we need to be careful to keep that in place because that's pretty difficult to get a notary to come to your home personally to be able to do that. But other than that provision, I think we have to think about as Republicans, you know, do we believe in less government? And this is one of those areas where I probably differ a little bit. I'm not out to remove the excuse-based system. That is not on my agenda. But certainly, personally, I feel like that government should not have to know any more about my business than they have to.
It's the legislature's responsibility.
Yes.
Anyways, would you want to make Election Day a state holiday?
You know, that is widely debated because not everyone gets a holiday to be able to do that. I think we need to have a lot of discussions with businesses across the state. That sounds a lot better in theory than it may necessarily in practice. And so we certainly do want more people voting. But if you look at the major elections, are you just going to do it for November? What about April? You know, you've got a lot of elections. So how do you handle that? Because April elections are no less important than federal November general elections.
I know they can be some of the most important elections.
Yes.
Because they hit closest to home. Let's talk about a ballot initiative that's going to be on in November, ranked choice voting. Mm-hmm. And also a ban on non-citizens voting. Mm-hmm. Do you want to ban ranked choice voting, like, first of all?
I've never been a proponent of ranked choice voting. One of the reasons I'm not a fan of it is that, you know, oftentimes if you're a principled conservative or a principled liberal, there's certain individuals you're not going to vote for because they're just contrast to the views that you have. If you go down the ticket of ranked choice voting and you get to two candidates that are just opposite of what you believe, you're likely not going to vote for either candidate. So therefore, your voice is not heard. That's why I'm not a fan of that particular model. I want to make sure that the voice is heard all the way through. And in some of those elections, less voters are making the final choice than the original amount of voters that voted in the first round of ranked choice voting.
So let's talk about the non-citizen ban. I think that a lot of reporters have pointed out it's already illegal to vote if you're a non-citizen, I guess, in state and federal elections. I guess the question is, whether that would apply to local elections. And I guess that maybe this language is just being extra super duper sure. First of all, is that your understanding too, before I get to my next question?
Yes, because other states, local municipalities have allowed people to vote in their local elections. And so the purpose of this is to ensure that regardless of its local, state, or federal, you are a U.S. citizen before you vote.
Okay. I keep posing this question to Republican candidates, and I know that no one is going to agree with me on this. But, okay, I understand that, like, we shouldn't have undocumented immigrants vote in elections. Like, that they're already breaking the law by being here, and I don't have any quarrel with that. Where I kind of have some intellectual disagreement is talking about, like, green card holders or legal immigrants getting to vote for, like, city council or mayor or something like that. Like, these people came to the country legally. They pay taxes. It may take them 10-plus years to get citizenship, but they're still going to be living in a community that has governmental officials that are going to affect their lives that they may want to stay on. So what is so objectionable about having that subset of immigrants vote in local elections?
I think for me, it always goes back to the men and women who have fought to protect this country and the sacrifice they've made, and many have had family members who have not come home, that the bare minimum that I think honors that is that we as citizens have the right to vote. And when you begin to whittle away at that, I think it begins to devalue your citizenship as an individual. And so I always want to honor and respect those who have fought for our country, especially those who have given their life for our country, and say, if you want to be in this country, we welcome you. We want you to be a citizen before you become a voter. And I think that's where I've always landed on that issue.
So let's talk in the final part of the show. Let's talk about probably the most high profile issue of the last legislative session, and that is making the Missouri Constitution more difficult to amend. So voters are not voting on that. Mm-hmm. There was a proposal to require constitutional amendments to not only get a majority, but pass in 5 out of 8 congressional districts. What do you think about philosophically the idea of the Constitution being harder than just a simple majority? And did you like that particular idea that almost made it to voters?
I'm never a big fan of big constitutions. I think they should be small. I think it should be to the point, and that the statute should be where you make the changes in terms of your laws. We, of course, have a fairly decent-sized constitution as compared to the U.S. Constitution. I think at the end of the day, though, this issue settled a long time ago. You're not going to tell the voters, in my opinion, they're probably not going to vote for this. For example, as you know, legislators used to vote for the U.S. Senator, and that changed years ago. And now the people vote for who represents them in the U.S. Senate in terms of that was one of the amendments to the Constitution. Voters are not going to have something taken away from them, in my strong opinion. And so I appreciate the idea because I do want a limited and small Constitution. But I don't see practically the voters doing that, especially when I watched what happened in Ohio.
And Arkansas. Arkansas, which is not bordering Springfield, but it's pretty close to Springfield, mm-hmm. is not exactly a blue utopia. It is arguably more Republican than both Missouri and Ohio. And they also rejected an effort to make the Constitution harder to amend. Yeah. And I think that, like, the calculus of the legislature this cycle was, like, the only way that this could have any chance of passing is you have to put other things on it, like the non-citizen voting ban and stuff like that. And, look, I understand that other groups have used, quote-unquote, ballot candy before. We can bring up the Clean Missouri example. We could bring up the 2008 loss limit measure that was marketed as getting rid of the loss limits, but also capped the amount of casinos that there could be. I kind of think that was actually ballot candy too, but I'm not even sure that would have passed either based off of precedent. Is that basically what you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, I think at the end of the day, voters are smart, especially when it comes to issues like that. And again, I could be wrong. I'm always gonna be for a limited constitution, but I realize, for example, I'm not a guy that, voted to legalize marijuana. A lot of people disagreed with me this last election, and I don't see how an issue like that in terms of your right to be able to have an impact on your constitution and or your statutes people are going to take away from themselves.
There's another factor I think that's going to affect the future of this issue, and that is the abortion legalization measure. Mm-hmm. I think that there is an assumption that if that passes, first of all, we got to make clear, Secretary Ashcroft has not said it's going to be on the ballot yet, but I mean, it got, they turned in a lot of signatures. I think it's likely, but we won't know it for sure until August. But I think it, the idea is if that does end up passing, the enthusiasm to make the Constitution harder to amend is going to go way down until the legislature puts something else on the ballot that repeals it or something like that. Because, like, you don't want to be put in – if you're somebody who is opposed to abortion rights, you don't want to be put in a position where it's suddenly very hard to amend the Constitution and suddenly this amendment that legalizes abortion is impossible to take out. So well, what's kind of your thought about
and
that?
And I'm glad you said that because I've thought about that many times in terms of my conservative friends just on the stem cell constitutional amendment issue years ago back in 2006. You know, I was not a favor of that. I was not a proponent of that, but it passed. Suddenly you make it harder to be able to go in and make any changes to that. How do you justify that in terms of an issue like that? And I think the abortion one is no different than that. For people that, you know, look at life as an issue that I know I do. I'm pro-life. I believe in the sacredness of life. And so when you suddenly make it harder to be able to amend something when something like that passes, I think you would regret that later on if you see an opportunity for that measure like that be able to pass with a simple 50% plus one. So I think that's why you've got to really think through these issues before you end up doing something that later on you look back and regret.
Well, Mr. Clerk, I guess that's what I'm going to call you. Thank you so much for coming to talk with us today. For all of our coverage of the Secretary of State's race and every other election in Missouri, make sure to go to stlpr.org. Politically Speaking is a product of St. Louis Public Radio, which is a part of the University of Missouri St. Louis. And how could people learn more about your campaign, either through a website or social media?
For social media, they can go to @ShaneSchuller on Facebook and Twitter, or I'm sorry, X. And then they can also go to ShaneForSOS.com for the website.
Thank you very much. Until next time, so long.
If you have a smart speaker, you have access to the entire world of NPR and St. Louis Public Radio. All the latest news and all the captivating stories. Activate our voices with yours by telling your smart speaker to play St. Louis Public Radio.